Time to take a look at the stars here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Astronomy on our minds now as we visit with Jim Lattice, director of the UW-Madison Space Place. He's a faculty associate in the UW-Madison Department of Astronomy as well. Space Place is located on South Park Street, 2300 South Park, in the Villager Mall in Madison. So we're really pleased to have him back. Jim?
Hi, Larry. Happy New Year.
Yeah, Happy New Year to you as well. With us by phone, Kelly Beatty is the award-winning executive editor of Sky and Telescope magazine, joining us for the first time, I believe. Kelly, hi.
Hey, Larry. How are you?
Well, great. Thank you very much for being with us today. Happy New Year to you.
To you, too.
You have an asteroid named after you.
I do.
How did that happen?
Well, I went to Caltech and made the acquaintance of an asteroid hunter there by the name of Eleanor Helene. And when I got married in 1983, she, being a good friend, took one of her discoveries and named it after me and my wife to sort of commemorate our marriage. It was a lovely present. The way this works is if you discover an asteroid, you as the discoverer get to name it after basically anything or anyone you want except yourself. Whereas if you discover a comet, you get to name, the comet becomes named after you. So you maybe want to discover comets and not asteroids, but unless you like to give gifts.
Jim Lattice, have you ever had an asteroid named after you?
No, indeed. I wish I had. That would be fun.
Oh, my goodness. Well, I tell you what, there's lots we can talk about. Let me give the numbers. If you have a question for Kelly or for Jim, give us a call at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or in the Madison area, reach us at 263-1890, 263-1890. We can talk about what to consider in choosing a telescope, for example. We can talk about the planets and what's going on in the sky right now. There's lots we can visit with. Again, the number 1-800-642-1234 in Madison at 263-1890. And Jim, I tell you what, lots of things going on event-wise here. Let's just talk about a couple of those, even including tonight, I believe.
Right. We have a lot of stuff happening, as always, really, at Space Place. And tonight we have our annual New Year's Eve event, which is part of the U.S. Bank Eve events around town. In fact, it's the only thing we do all year that requires a ticket. so you have to get a ticket from U.S. Bank Eve, but then that lets you into all of their New Year's Eve sites, which include Old Brick Gardens and all the events on the square and things like that. So at Space Place, we will have, as usual, some science education activities. This year, our theme is sound. So we'll have the Wonders of Physics from the UW Physics Department is going to be doing some sound-related activities and demonstrations. And we have a musical instrument specialist who's going to come in with activities, hands-on activities for sound and acoustics. And then when you need a break from the from all the noise, all the noise-making, then we'll have our telescope set up on the roof for stargazing if the sky clears, knock on wood. Before this evening, we'll try to get some good viewing of Mars and other things.
Okay. Well, I'll tell you what, Dan in Pewaukee has a question for us. So let's go to Dan. Hi, Dan. Thank you for calling.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I am fascinated by astrological bodies, and I am very much interested in picking out a telescope, and I'd like some guidance on doing that. I'm 59 and would like to get into it. I enjoy, and I would like to be able to use my digital camera to take photographs as well.
Okay.
So any advice that you could provide, I'd be much appreciative.
Well, let's start with Kelly Beatty. Kelly, what are you advising?
Okay. Well, are you mostly thinking that you're going to be looking or photographing? Because they're actually the looking is a lot easier, you know. The photographing comes with a little bit of pain and suffering.
I'm willing to go through the pain and suffering.
All right. So what you want is you want a telescope that can track the sky, because just like the sun rises in the east and sets in the west, so too do the stars. And although they move imperceptibly, they move pretty quickly when you're trying to take pictures of stars or galaxies through a telescope and magnifying the view. So you want a telescope that will track the sky and not just there are two kinds that do that. One is these newer go-to or computerized telescopes that you see many of, they look like a telescope that sits on top of a tripod pretty straight up, and they move sort of side to side and up and down, much as you would move a camera tripod, a camera on a tripod. That won't do for really long exposures, because although those telescopes do track the sky, it's a quirky thing, but the sky rotates as they follow it. So what you want is a telescope with what's called an equatorial mount. And these are actually pretty common. They're what a lot of people think of when they see a telescope. That you'll know that you're on the right track if you see a telescope whose mount has axes that kind of angle up at odd angles, like bad plumbing. And those kinds of telescopes equipped with a motor to track the sky move very smoothly and will follow anything that you set them on, and in particular will allow you to use a camera with it. Now, that's just the mount part. The optics are a different story altogether, and there you really have a lot of options. You can get a telescope that uses lenses to collect the light, a lens, and that's a refractor. That's what I think most people think of when they think of a telescope. Or you can get a reflector, which uses a curved mirror, paraboloidal mirror at the back end, to collect the light and concentrate it. Both of those come on equatorial mounts, and they're both very good. You can get, now I know you want to know how much, you can get a very good quality tracking equatorial mount refractor or reflector for $400 to $600. I wouldn't spend anything less than that,
about the price range I was thinking about. Do you have a preference for refractor or reflector?
No. The way this process works is that a refractor tends to give, you know, just a little bit on average better contrast. That is, if you're taking a photo of the moon or of Jupiter or Mars right now, they tend to be a little bit sharper. Reflectors aren't quite as sharp because they have some parts in the way that kind of diffuse the light a little bit, but the reflector can give you a bigger collecting surface, a bigger aperture, as we like to say, for the more bang for your buck in that sense. So here's the decision you need to make. If you're more likely to photograph the moon and planets, I'd get a refractor. If you're more likely to go after galaxies and faint nebulae, then you might go after a reflector, but the shadings are pretty close. You'd be happy with one or the other. One other thing to notice, don't necessarily think just in terms of a traditional camera when photographing. The new wave in astrophotography is to get a webcam, believe it or not, either in color or black and white, and actually take digital video of your target. And then there's some software that's freely available. One that's really common is called Registax, with an X on the end. And you can actually go through your video and select the very best frames of the video and then add them together to create a composite image. Now, why would you want to do that? That's because the air above us is very turbulent. And so if you were to take a single photo that's, say, 5 minutes long, you get the good and the bad in that. You'll have moments when the atmosphere is very steady, and so the detail is sharp. And in other moments when things are like looking at a coin in the bottom of a pool, they're all murky and turbulent. By going through the video frame by frame, you can actually, the software picks the ones that are best and allows you to add those only to get a really good sharp image that's actually far better than you could get with just a single shot on your camera.
Oh, interesting.
I've got a webcam, so I'm going to look into that. Yeah. Thank you very much.
Hey, you're very welcome.
Yeah, Jim, anything to add to that?
Only that if he's going to go with a webcam or a specific astronomical camera, as opposed to his own camera, then his options are a little bit wider. If he's got a particular camera he wants to use, then I was going to say you ought to be really careful about what its weight is, and think about how it's going to be mounted on that telescope, because hanging off the end of a refractor it could lead to some sort of mounting complications. And
right,
things like
and most webcams don't weigh all that much, but the advantage of buying one specifically for astrophotography, and they're not that expensive. The webcams themselves are a couple hundred dollars, and typically they include software that will allow you to do this stacking I just told you about, is that they have the all-important connector that allows you to slip it into the place where an eyepiece on your telescope would ordinarily go. Otherwise, you have to kind of kludge something together or get a kit to adapt the one that you've got. So what I would say is just keep the webcam that you've got for, like, you know, doing Skype and smiling faces to your friends and family in different places. And then get a webcam specifically for astrophotography. And most of the major manufacturers sell them.
Perfect.
All right.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it, and Happy New Year to everyone.
Yep. How do you too?
Happy New Year to you. Thank you very much for calling. You can join in, too, at 1-800-642-1234 or in Madison at 263-1890, Talking Astronomy Today with Jim Lattice and Kelly Beatty. Really pleased to have them with us today on this New Year's Eve. And, Jim, the Washburn Observatory is now closed. Why is it closed? Can you talk a second about that?
Certainly, yeah. It closed at the beginning of November for renovations. This will be the first time that the building has had significant work on it. As you probably know, we've talked about it before. The observatory here on campus goes back to 1881.
Yeah.
But the astronomy department actually moved out of there, except we still get to use the telescope. The astronomy department moved out of there in, I think it was 1959, at which time a lot of modifications were made to the building to accommodate its occupants, which for many years there, in fact, up until just this past fall, was the Institute for Research in the Humanities here at the university. So they had that prime spot up there on top of Observatory Hill. And the plan now is for the building is in need of another major renovation, and in particular, they need accessibility requirements. They're going to move the Letters and Science Honors Program into that beautiful spot up on the hill there. And so a lot of the building needs to be brought up to date, and new entrances and an elevator and all sorts of modern things have to go into the building. So it's going to be closed now until the current schedule calls for it to reopen in the summer of 2009. So the impact for most of us is that the 120-odd-year tradition of public observing nights on Wednesday nights is now suspended necessarily because we at a certain point there won't even be a stairway up to the telescope, so we can't go check on it until the building is renovated and reopened. So we have two alternatives to that, though, of course. Down at Space Place, we have for a long time now done public observing nights on the second and fourth Fridays of each month, and we'll keep on doing that. Starting in February, the Astronomy Department grad students are going to offer public viewing on the roof of Sterling Hall with a small, a beautiful 6-inch Clark refractor. It's actually older than the Washburn refractor, and it's a lovely instrument. And so starting, I think, February 6th, their website, the Astronomy Department website, will have that, as well as the Space Place website, spaceplace.org. So there'll be lots of opportunities for sky gazing while the observatory reopens, and then, of course, rather is renovated, and then when it reopens, I'm sure we'll have a big event up there.
I'm sure you will. Jim Lattice, director of the UW-Madison Space Place, and Kelly Beatty, award-winning executive editor of Sky and Telescope, with us today. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All of our lines are filled with questioners, so we'll go right back to the phones here and to Beth in Milwaukee next. Beth, hi to you.
Hello. I just couldn't resist. The reason that you can get a comet or an asteroid named after you is because you have friends in high places. Thank you very much for your show. It's still a wonder and a mystery out there when you look up at the sky. Jared, Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
That's great.
Another caller wanted to know the official name of that asteroid, by the way, Kelly.
Well, it's actually officially named Beatty.
Beatty.
And there are two designations. There's that, which is what I like to use, and then it has a numerical designation, which is 2925. Now, you can appreciate that there's more than 100,000 asteroids now that have names associated with them. So I'm up there in the, you know, on the A-list, and I feel pretty special about that.
Friends in high places, as Beth says. Well, let's go to Mike in New Berlin. Mike, hi to you.
Hi, good morning.
Morning.
Say, I'm making a telescope, and I've got a piece of glass that I've got figured pretty well, and I'm looking to start testing it with a knife edge.
Okay.
And I was just wondering if you can point me to some spots where I might be able to find more information. First off, I'm having trouble finding the focus point, and then when I do, I'm having trouble interpreting the images.
Right. Well, there are obviously a lot of books on this subject. Online, one of the places I would go is to the Stellafane website. This is stellafane.com. Okay. This is the website of the granddaddy of all star parties, Stellafane, which is held every year in southern Vermont. And that group got its start because there were a bunch of machinists in that part of Vermont who just loved to build their own telescopes. This is back in the 1930s, and that tradition continues. The other thing I can suggest is, I'm sorry, are you living in Madison or nearby?
No, I'm in Milwaukee.
Or even better. The Milwaukee Astronomical Society probably has some people in the club who are already doing a lot of telescope making. Are you a member of that club?
I know of it.
Okay. I would contact them. Often they have workshops specially just for telescope making where they'll have the knife edge and the other kinds of testers already set up for you. And, most importantly, those helpful mentors who can guide you through the final figuring process.
Yeah, that's the important part. If somebody's already done it, they know what they're doing.
Exactly.
Yeah, exactly. Good luck. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. Jim, you have some telescope-related events going on.
We do, yeah. We have our annual winter telescope fair and clinic, which will be on the 22nd of January. And that's a very helpful event for people who are in the market for a telescope. We do that with Madison Astronomical Society and Eagle Optics. They come down and help out as well. And so we invite people to bring in their telescope, old or new, it doesn't matter, and we'll help get it set up and give you tips on using it. But it's also a good time for people who are interested in buying a telescope or making a telescope to see, because we have a couple of home-built telescopes that we set out as well for people to look at, and we can talk about telescope building on that occasion. So that's, again, at Space Place on the 22nd of January, 7 to 9 p.m.
And I should mention that you have a website, obviously, and what's that website?
It's called, the easiest form is spaceplace.org, O-R-G.
Spaceplace.org. And Kelly, you have, obviously, Sky and Telescope has a website as well.
Right. Ours is skyandtelescope.com. It's all spelled out and all run together. And among other things, you'll find there are things to look at in the sky and how to use telescopes. And we have more than 1,000 articles online that are accessible free, including how to choose a telescope, for example.
All right, good enough. Let's go to Tracy in Laval next. Tracy, hi to you.
Good morning.
Morning.
I've always been curious, kind of a physics question. What actually causes the Earth to tilt in December and June? I've always found it amazing that on cue, the Earth starts tilting one way and then the other in December and June. What
yeah.
actually causes the Earth to do that?
It's all those people from the Northeast U.S. going to Florida.
No, it's not that. Kelly probably knows. Jim, why don't you throw in a word or two here?
Well, certainly it's not tilting suddenly, despite all the people going to Florida. It's tilting all year long. The tilt is the relationship between the Earth's rotational axis and its orbital plane. And it's as if you put a gyroscope on the edge of an old LP turntable or something and let it turn around. If you had a perfect gyroscope, it would point in the same direction towards your ceiling fan, say, as you rotate the record around, the turntable around. The tilt would always be there. The tilt would be 23.5 degrees or so with respect to the record, mm-hmm. the outer edge of the LP. But twice a year, that axis would point either toward or away from the center of the hub, and those are the center of the record, and that's your solstices. So it doesn't suddenly tilt. It tilts all year long, but it aligns or lines up with the direction to the sun, in our case, twice a year.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Yep. Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate it. John in Darlington. Let's go to you now. Hi, John.
Hi. Morning.
Morning. What can we do for you?
I would like to ask the astronomers what's going on with the Hubble telescope.
All right. Kelly, do you know what's going on with the telescope?
Well, the telescope is doing pretty well. It has about a half dozen instruments on board, one of which is broken right now. In fact, its best camera, called the Advanced Camera for Surveys, died a few months ago.
Oh, too bad.
And so the good news is that NASA has been planning to go back to the Hubble telescope one more time, probably about a year from now, to do one final repair mission.
The money to do that?
They have the money. There are replacement instruments and cameras all completed and ready to go. This is actually a triumph of common sense over politics.
Good.
After Columbia was lost, the space shuttle Columbia was lost a few years ago, the guy who was then administrator of NASA, named Sean O'Keefe, decided that any mission other than to the International Space Station was too risky for the space shuttle. And the Hubble mission, which has already been planned, was one of those. So he decided to cancel that mission. And the outcry from astronomers and from people who, including NASA engineers, who said, but it's really not that unsafe, was so great that eventually that mission was restored. And so that will be, you know, the space shuttle is kind of winding down its 30-year career. And this will be one of the final missions of the space shuttle, which is to go back to the Hubble Space Telescope, replace those instruments, get it in as best shape as they can, and in particular, they'll be attaching a motor to it that when it reaches the end of its life, they'll be able to drive it into the atmosphere safely so it will burn up over an ocean somewhere. It will not be coming back to the Smithsonian, unfortunately.
Hubble is very important.
In the meantime, it's taking fantastic images of all kinds of things. One of the most recent things I saw, we were talking about Mars a little bit earlier. Mars right now is about as close as it gets to Earth, and it's really at its closest until, I think, 2016. And so as a consequence, the Hubble took, within the last couple of weeks, some really nice images of the planet Mars that show incredible detail, and so it's still out there and working for us every day.
All right.
Yeah, the big mystery will be once that servicing mission is completed, how long can they keep it going along usefully? And they've been getting better and better as the years pass in dealing with various kinds of failures, gyroscope failures, which have been a big problem, and electrical failures and things like that. So if they can keep it ticking along, then we may squeeze more science out of it as the years go by.
Right. Those gyroscopes are what they use to point it, and they're spinning all the time, and so they mechanically just break every once in a while. And although they have some spares, eventually, they'll have too few gyroscopes to point it accurately, and at that point, it'll be pretty much a done deal.
Yeah. Sounds great.
All right. Thanks, John.
Yep.
Appreciate the call. Paul in Galesville, you are next. Hi, Paul.
Hi. I wanted to go back to the cameras you were talking about for astrophotography. One thing that Kelly didn't mention was that if you use a webcam, you need to have a computer with you at the telescope. And if you, some other options, point and shoot digital cameras, some of them are pretty useful too. I've gotten some nice planet pictures with those. And those you can just take the video at the telescope and then go to your computer if you don't have a laptop or a computer you can bring with you. And then another thing is the new digital SLR cameras also work just amazingly well.
They absolutely do. A friend of mine named Alan Dyer just got back from Australia, where, among other things, you can see things that you can't see here in our northern sky, and the Milky Way is far, far better. And he just brought back some amazing stuff, all done with a digital SLR camera, a single lens. What we think of as a higher end camera, but now they're all digital, attached to a simple refracting telescope on a mount that followed the stars, and it just blows me away what he's able to do. You're absolutely right that the digital SLRs are great cameras, and so are the point-and-shoots. I have a little point-and-shoot myself that, you know, it will take an image about 15 or 20 seconds or so before it tops out.
Yeah.
The advantage of some of the higher-end cameras is that they have, you know, at those long exposures, the simple cameras, the simple digital cameras, tend to have a lot of noise in them that creates fuzziness in the images. And so that's why either a webcam, again, you're right, you need a laptop out with your computer to make that work right, or a higher-end camera will certainly do a really good job for you.
Yeah. Thanks, Paul.
Sure.
Yeah, appreciate the call. And let's see, who's next? Brad, I believe, is next in River Falls. Hi, Brad.
Hi. I have a couple of questions. One is a space travel question, and one is a general question about space. And the space travel question is it possible to put either a manned or unmanned spacecraft in orbit around the sun in the opposite direction that the Earth is going, and then rendezvous with it, meet up with it again in 6 months on the other side of the sun? And the general space question is, we were taught when I was in school that the universe was everything that there was, and since then I've heard talk about how there's numbers of different universes, and I'm wondering how that can be, and if so, what do they call everything now?
Well, those are some big questions. Jim Lattice?
Your first question is the easier one. The answer is yes, you can certainly do that, although there's not enough rocket power among the nations that can do it right now to put a spacecraft in that kind of an orbit. You'd have to counter the Earth's orbital speed and then give it the equivalent amount in the opposite direction to meet it going the other way.
Right. The escape velocity just to get away from Earth is 7 miles a second. And then on top of that, Earth's orbital velocity moving around the sun is another 20 miles a second. So you would have to really get up there. Now, there is another way to do that, and you can use the gravitational power of some of the planets, and especially Jupiter, to do that. About 15 years ago, the Europeans launched a solar mission called Ulysses, which went out to the planet Jupiter and passed it in such a way that Jupiter yanked the orbit essentially up.
Right, so out of the plane.
Sent out of the plane of right. That the other planets follow. So think of it as going up and down around the sun as opposed to around in the middle. And Ulysses continues to function, but it would be really tough to do.
Yeah. And then the other multiple universe question. Jim, we can start with you on that.
Well, sure. I mean, that's. I think we're talking words here. It reminds me of the discussions of, is Pluto a planet? The problem is, how do you want to use your words, and do you want to give scientific definitions to commonplace words? And so we use the term universe typically to mean everything that there is, but astronomers like to use the term visible universe. And that's everything that we can see, everything that we can measure, that we can talk about in any kind of reasonable terms. There are, of course, all the multiverse theories and things like that that clearly you've been reading about. And so then the meaning of the word universe starts to get fuzzy, and nobody has agreed on whether we're going to call all of that the universe or whether we're talking about, as astronomers do, the visible universe.
Or whether, in fact, we could even detect those. I mean, this is where, for many, many decades, theorists had it all over the observational astronomers because they could cook up ideas that couldn't be tested. And this
that may not always be true, though.
on paper, theorists can conceive of how other universes might have come to be in parallel with our own. The problem is we can only observe the one we're in. And so we may never be able to test whether or not other universes exist because we simply can't see outside the one we've got.
Yeah, interesting.
Okay.
Thanks, Brad.
Thank you.
Paul in Duluth, Minnesota, your turn now. Hi, Paul.
Hello. I've got a question, but I consider myself a plutocrat, a Democrat who believes that Pluto is a planet.
Okay.
Anyway, I'm wondering about I've been following probably one of the most amazing things I've ever seen was, what was it, the Hale-Bopp comet that slammed into Jupiter?
It was the comet Schumacher-Levy 9.
Schumacher-Levy, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Anyway, I'm wondering about this asteroid that's going to hit Mars.
Or
maybe. I've heard, several months ago, I heard it was a 1 in 75 chance. Now I'm hearing 1 in 25.
That's the latest number, yeah.
Yeah. Are there enough observational posts around Mars that we might actually be able to see that?
That's a great question. That's a really great question. The answer is yes. There are three spacecraft in orbit around Mars right now. Two are from NASA. One is from the Europeans, any of which could see this thing hit when and if it does. And I can tell you that it will be you got your calendar out?
Well, I was going to say, I heard it was sometime in January.
January 30th. Right, January 30th, at 4:56 a.m. Now, I expect you to be up and watching, okay? but if it does hit, it should create a crater roughly a half a mile to a mile across, which is easily big enough for any of those spacecraft to see it and watch it happen. It would be fantastic if that were the case. But, as Jim will probably tell you, the fact that it has a 1 in 25 chance of hitting means that it has a 96% chance of not hitting.
I wasn't that good at math. That's why I didn't become an astronomer.
Well, the odds may still change. They're pretty attentively observing this asteroid, and a lot of that uncertainty, though, the reason that you're getting odds instead of a yes or no sort of thing, is that the exact path of the asteroid is not determined with high enough precision just yet. And so they're working on that. We may see those numbers change as the time approaches.
What's going to happen is probably within the next week, because of the position of the moon and this asteroid, it's a very faint little blip out there. It's only about 150. Think of a skyscraper, big skyscraper, and that's a word of the size this thing is. It's very hard to see, and when the moon is in the way, it's impossible to observe. Within the next week, astronomers, I was just checking this morning to see if anybody had swept it up, but they haven't. Astronomers will get new positions of this asteroid. Remember, it was only discovered back on November 20th, so they don't have a lot of data on it. And they'll be able to, as Jim was saying, they'll be able to refine that orbit and probably say, they'll definitely be able to say if it misses, if it's going to miss, and if it is going to hit, those odds will start to get narrower and narrower until it is going to strike. But the chances are very great that it's actually going to miss. Right now, all else being equal, it's going to miss Mars by about 15,000 miles. close but no cigar.
Close but no cigar. Thanks for calling, Paul. Appreciate it. Appreciate it very much. Mike in Waukesha, it's your turn. Mike, hello.
Good morning. I've always admired Dr. Carl Sagan because he was, in my opinion, the best of the brilliant people, because he could explain things that were so complicated in such simple terms that even the layperson would understand. And I've always been fascinated with astronomy, but when I read his books or listened to him talk, it was just even more exciting. My problem is, what would Carl Sagan do regarding our current state of the planet? I listened to an astronomer last night on public TV talk about billions of light years away, and I guess my question is, you know, we may have the Venus atmosphere here in another 50 years if we don't really wake up, because in terms of what's happening in our current day and age, we got an economic or an environmental crisis here that I think the astronomers and the physicists and the chemists need to start joining in on. That is climate change. If I worry about what's 1,000 years ahead, but we don't have an environment that will support life in the next 50 years, I don't know what else to say that will get the war effort approach mentality in line, because the astronomers are talking about light years away, and we may have an environment that duplicates Venus in the next 100 years. So how do we get the war effort to start thinking in terms of what's here and now, and what the mm-hmm. real risks are?
Okay, well, let's go to Jim Lattice first. Jim.
Well, I was just going to observe that I can't speak for all astronomers by a long shot, but what I do is talk to the meteorologists and the climatologists who understand that research. And the consensus from them is pretty convincing, and I don't know if it agrees quite with the scenario of Venus in 50 years, but the trend is an important one. And I'm just going to point out that you're going to have Steve Ackerman on shortly. And he's really the kind of guy that I would go talk to about these sorts of things. But I don't think you'll see physicists and astronomers. I think you'll see them deferring to the climatologists. And it's these guys who are going to lead the way for us.
Yeah. Yep. And I thank you very much for calling. And I hope you stay tuned, Mike, because I'm sure we're going to be discussing that coming up here in just a few minutes, as a matter of fact. So stay with us, and we'll get our climatologists on and see what they've got to say. Kay in Marshfield has a comment question. Kay, hi.
A comment. I subscribe to a monthly sky calendar type thing from the University of Michigan. It's called At the Abrams Planetarium that I like. One side has the whole month plotted out like a calendar and shows where the different planets, stars, and things are and what time. And the other side has a round globe that you would hold overhead so that you can identify the night sky.
Yeah.
And I like that. I've subscribed to that for years.
Yeah, that's a wonderful resource. I like that too.
Yeah, $11 a year. And should I give an address?
Give us the name again.
It's let's see here, the Sky Calendar. It's called
and it's
Abrams Planetarium.
Oh, Abrams Planetarium. Okay,
mm-hmm. That's ABRAMS.
Yes,
Abrams Planetarium. Right.
Right.
That's really been around for, I don't know, at least 30 years. The guy who started it was Robert C. Victor, and I'm not sure if Bob is still involved with that or not, but he sort of institutionalized those little simple graphics along the horizon showing the location of planets and star groupings. And you're right, it's a really nice resource.
Thank you very much for calling, Kay. Appreciate it. And I'm going to find lots of things in Sky and Telescope as well.
Absolutely. I mean, Robert, Bob Victor used to write for us back in the day, and we've sort of carried on that tradition that when we produce graphics showing what to see in the sky, we'll use his style of just taking, rather than trying to show the whole sky all at once, we'll take a chunk along the horizon, which people can relate to a lot easier, it seems, and just show what the prominent stars and planets will be there. Jim, I don't know if you mentioned this. Right now, one of the most dominant things in the evening sky is the planet Mars. And just quickly, once it gets dark, if you look in the direction opposite where the sun set, which is sort of in the northeast, you'll see a brilliant star kind of all by itself. That's not a star. That's the planet Mars. And if you look really hard, you can maybe convince yourself that it's kind of peachy colored and not like a brilliant, cool white. That's because, quite literally, the rocks on the surface of Mars are rusty, and that's what gives it that that sort of ruddy hue.
Yeah, it's more of a yellow planet than a red planet. But it's,
right.
But
that's
it, right. Is easy to find. You're quite right out there.
Oh, guys, thank you so much. This has been a lot of fun. Kelly, thank you very much for being with us today.
Oh, a great pleasure, Larry. Glad to be able to join you.
Thank you very much. Kelly Beatty, award-winning executive editor of Sky and Telescope. And go on their website, Sky and Telescope. It's all one word, skyandtelescope.com. Jim Lattice, always a pleasure. And all the events and everything are up on your...
on the website at spaceplace.org.
Mm-hmm. Spaceplace.org. Jim Lattice, director of the UW-Madison Space Place. Well, coming up, we're going to take a look at weather and climate with our weather guys. Next here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Glad to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here. And it's time to take a look at climate and weather with our weather guys. Steve Ackerman, professor, director of the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies at UW-Madison. And John Martin, chair of the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. He's a professor as well at UW-Madison. They come by the last Monday of every month. And boy, we're the last day of this month to talk climate and weather with them. And I hope you'll join in. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. If you're in Madison, reach us at 263-1890. 263-1890. Give us a call with your questions and comments. Steve, welcome back.
It's great to be back.
And John, good to have you back as well.
Thanks, Larry. Same here.
Just before you guys came on board, and another caller who worried about climate change and taking he mentioned Venus and the atmosphere that the Earth's atmosphere could possibly be like Venus's atmosphere in maybe 50 years. That's probably way.
Yeah, I'd add several, many more zeros, maybe, even if we could even get to Venus.
We'd have to have 20,000 times the amount of carbon dioxide in our atmosphere in 50 years, and that's not going to happen.
That's not going to happen.
No, that's a doomsday scenario that's impossible.
Okay. Nevertheless,
be careful. Nevertheless, we need to clean up our act, but we're not under that kind of threat.
All right. That's good to know. That's good to know. And I'm sure we'll probably get some questions relating to climate as we go along here. Somebody wondered what's the difference between freezing rain and freezing drizzle?
Purely the size of the raindrop. Yeah. So drizzle is very small droplets, I think on the order of a half a centimeter or smaller, or quarter of a centimeter smaller.
Yeah, the small ones.
Yeah. So they're basically the small, tiny droplets that you would get. You know. So usually when we go outside, you know, we've just been so accustomed to it, I think. I mean, not just John and I, but I think everybody.
Yeah.
When you get that really, really light rain, we call that drizzle, which is what it is.
And there's even a microphysical difference, I think I'm right about this, that you can get drizzle drops to form in the absence of ice particles in the cloud, but you can't get raindrops in the middle latitudes to form in the absence of ice processes in the clouds.
Oh, yeah.
I think that's right. One of my good friends in Seattle is a real expert on that stuff, and I remember him telling me that. He'd say, you know, Johnny, they said it was drizzle today, and it couldn't have been drizzle. Minus 10 and 8 or whatever. He just would get so upset about that, but that's the case.
Oh, man. Well, Roy in Appleton has a question for you, so let's go to Roy. Roy, hi.
Hi, how are you? I am driving right now through the most beautiful display of hoarfrost I've seen in many a year.
Yeah.
We're coming down from Mountain, Wisconsin, heading down back to Appleton. But that's not the source of my question. We've been up in Norway, Michigan, teaching skiing, and our place is at Lakewood, Wisconsin, in northern Oconto County. The question is we've had several fronts go through. They've been pretty benign. Sunny for part of the day, then it starts snowing at night, and you pick up 3 inches. The next morning, it's 14 degrees, and then it gets sunny. And then we get another front with another inch of snow, and it's happened 3 times in the last several days.
Hmm.
But there's been no discernible frontal zones that you could feel. Can you discuss it?
Yeah, I think that's really interesting. And you're near the lake, of course, so part of that snow is coming from the lake. Is that right?
No, that's still a couple hundred miles south of Lake Superior. So Norway, Michigan is near Iron Mountain. They don't really
get Superior
effect snow.
Yeah, you're
so
far away from
basically that. Those fronts are coming either out of the northwest or circulating around. That was a concern.
Well, I wonder if you're not getting a little bit of an effect of the slightly increased elevation. If you're getting flow, I think predominantly we've had northwesterly flow in the lower part of the atmosphere over the last, well, not Friday and Saturday, but over the last couple of weeks that's been the case. And
yeah,
I wonder
because we're at 1,295 elevation at our cabin. And believe it or not, our cabin and Norway Mountain are about the same elevation. Let's say 1,300 feet.
Okay, so that helps. So you're going to get, even if you're 200 miles away from the lake, you get a moist flow of air off of the lake that's been moistened by the cold air coming over the lake. And then it rides up the side of the hill, and it actually squeezes that water vapor into ice, and I guess it's all ice if it's falling as snow.
Well, just keep it coming that way, will you, please?
Oh, yeah.
We need it.
You know, that's the thing. You know, we're in a pattern now, and it's been for the whole month, where we've stayed pretty much in northwesterly flow above the ground, and that's perfect for where you are, I guess.
Yeah,
perfect.
It is, and it's going to make a big difference for the people up in that resort area. And right now, I'm on near Shawano Lake, and it's a village out there with all the vehicles on the lake.
Mm. Oh, wow. I bet it
Thanks
is.
Up. Thanks for the help.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. You can join us, too, at 1-800-642-1234 or in Madison at 263-1890. If you've got a climate or weather question, we'd love to hear from you. Guys, Judah Cohen, who's direct seasonal forecasting at the Atmospheric and Environmental Research Center in Massachusetts, is one of the forecasters who's kind of at odds with the official federal forecast this winter. Now, he looks at snow cover in Siberia, for one thing, and he says that the extensive snow cover in Siberia means mild weather kicking in through early January and then a return to colder weather in the second half of January. How does that compare with the forecast for Wisconsin?
Well, the 10-day forecast right now is exactly in line with that. I think by about a week from tomorrow, we're going to have quite warm temperatures, warmer than we've had in 6 or 7 weeks. Now, I don't know what happens in the second half of the month. But I know this guy. This is a really interesting guy. I've known him for a number of years, and he's a smart guy. He's a very careful thinker, but he's not afraid to go out there on the to be out on the fringe a little bit.
And I know the NSEP forecast is for the seasonal is above average.
Yeah.
So he seems to be countering that by thinking some cold air outbreaks are going to be coming down.
I think it's hard to understand what might motivate that. If you have cold air over the Eastern Hemisphere, sometimes it sloshes across the pole and invades the Western Hemisphere, and I guess that's what he's thinking might happen. But that usually has something to do with what happens in the lower stratosphere, and it's very much more complicated than just that. And you can't see that clearly in advance. So I don't know what might motivate that forecast.
Well, I'll tell you what. Chris in Glendale has a question for you, so let us go there. Hi, Chris.
Hi, I'm located in Milwaukee County, and for 20 years I've been listening to the NOAA Weather Service for this area of Wisconsin. And I've noticed two distinct voices that give me the forecast and the current conditions. One of the voices is obviously a human being who has recorded something recently. The other sounds like it could be automated. Mm-hmm. In other words, there's a voice that has an odd sterile quality to it, and I wonder if I'm listening to a computer that has been filled with maybe complete sentences, maybe individual words, and somehow someone's typing on a keyboard, and I'm hearing a, I don't know, quasi-synthetic voice. What do you know about that?
It's entirely synthetic. They type in the text, and then I think they've dubbed this person Sven because they've given him some sort of a little Norwegian lilt to his computerized voice. And apparently that is the case. That's what they do now. And I don't know why.
That voice has just been recently updated, within the last 4 or 5 years. So it used to be really automated sounding. And now it actually sounds a lot better. So I think as you're saying, Chris, you kind of listen to it and you say, that's something's odd about that voice.
Yeah, wrong.
By the time you type it in, couldn't you just take a microphone and read it in?
Doesn't it seem reasonable? I mean, I don't understand. Is this really a labor-saving device, or is it just a test bed for some goofy computerized voice stuff? I don't know.
Yeah, I didn't think of it that way. That's
it seems like you could.
Yeah.
And well, they don't update that part of the forecast except every, 6 or 8 or even sometimes longer than that number of hours. So
We talk at about 150 words a minute, and unless you can type that fast.
Not me.
Not me.
Me either.
Not me.
I could talk a lot faster than that, actually.
That's normal. Normal conversation is 150 words a minute.
I think part of the motivation might be that the Weather Service has mandated that a lot of the forecast products go out in a digitized format so that they can catalog them in a uniform way, and this might be part of that effort, which is good and bad. I think the forecasters say that they spend a huge amount of time digitizing numerical forecast data when they could just as well make the forecast and take less time. Yeah. They uniformly have told me that. They're not happy with that mandate.
So there you have it, Chris.
Thank you. By the way, I'm waiting. At some point, I'm going to be in another state, and I'm going to turn on the weather radio there. And maybe when I hear a different forecast for a different state, it might be the same voice. I just don't know.
Oh, well, that would be interesting to know.
Yeah, that would really be interesting.
Yeah, maybe a different name. But
thanks, Chris.
Right.
Appreciate it. Joe and Eau Claire, it's your turn. Hi, Joe.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good. What can we do for you?
Well, I'm calling in to ask the guests with their opinion and perspective on a couple of authors I've read recently.
Okay.
One of the authors I read is Bill Ruderman, who wrote a book, Clouds, Plagues, and Petroleum. And another author wrote a book called Cool It, and it's kind of a skeptical environmentalist look at climate change. And both of these books kind of gelled what I was thinking in that the climate is changing. But the climate change that's occurring is more or less a symptom of a bigger problem, that is we're using all these fuels, and there's this huge hype about stopping global warming, and I'm kind of thinking it's like those geologists that have the bumper sticker stop plate tectonics, in that maybe we're looking at this in the wrong manner, given that, it's going to be 200 years before the Earth stops cooling anyhow. Maybe what we should be doing is focusing on adapting to the climate change and alternative energy rather than having this big panic such as our atmosphere is going to turn into Venus.
Yeah, I haven't read either of those books. So I'm not sure what those authors are saying particularly, but I think your general gist is that, we are seeing global change occurring, and the issue is, what are we going to do about it now? Are we going to do anything or not do anything?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think this is a good point, that You know, you brought up the point about the Venusian atmosphere there at the end, and this is just part of the incredible amount of noise that goes on around this issue on both sides, actually. I don't think one side's more guilty than the other. But when you get right down to it, what we probably need to be thinking about is, what are our options? Our options are, we can certainly mitigate against further environmental damage by changing the way we do business. That's one. The other is definitely adaptation to an alternative climate. And we have to be thinking about both of those at the same time. And then maybe relaxing back through our efforts to clean up the environment back towards the climate system that we're more familiar with, the one that's been around for all these centuries that during which we've developed our civilization. But for a while, we're certainly going to have to deal with an altered climate, and we need to be thinking about both cleaning up our atmosphere and in addition, adapting to the changes that we've already wrought. But the rest of the stuff's noise, and maybe these authors are pointing some of that noise out, but I don't know if they're clearly getting down to the kernel of the issues. Yeah. I can't say. I haven't read the books.
Well, what is it? 85% of the electricity or energy that we use in the world comes from oil and coal.
Right, yep.
And, you know, we dig it up out of the ground, and when we release it, it releases billions of tons of carbon dioxide into the air.
Right. Yep. It's been out of play for millions of years, and the atmosphere can't take it.
Yeah.
It doesn't know what to do with it.
Well, we can take at least another half hour of this. we certainly can. Steve Ackerman, John Martin, our guest, and they'll be with us right up till 12:30 today here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Climate and weather on our minds right now here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here. My guest today, Steve Ackerman, director of the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies, and John Martin, professor, chair of the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW-Madison. And we're going to be talking about climate and weather, of course, with them. We'll take a look at we have a question about some current indicators on global warming. We'll look at freezing fog. Somebody wants a definition of that, and when does it occur? So we'll look at that. We'll take a look at some gigantic snowflakes, which have been seen in Wisconsin in the past month, and what causes that. And maybe we'll take a look back, and what was the hottest day of the year in Wisconsin, and what was the coldest, and we'll find all that stuff out. Our weather guys know the answers, and we'll be back with them right after this look at the news. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. Talking climate and weather now with our weather guys, Steve Ackerman and John Martin. Steve is director of the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies. John chairs the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW-Madison. Question for us, give us a call at 1-800-642-1234 in Madison at 263-1890. And let's turn to Phil in Mount Horeb, who's been patiently waiting. Phil, hi. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I've followed the global warming issue for five or more years, and I've become, as many citizens have, very concerned about the effects of methane and carbon dioxide on our atmosphere and the warming trend as a result. We talked earlier about global warming, but I think global climate change is a more appropriate nomer for that because of the variables that collide in that process. I wanted to ask you, your experts, what are the current incontrovertible, currently verifiable data that prove the presence of global warming? I run into some people who are still skeptical or even outright opposed to it, and persuading them with real data that is, you know, today as opposed to 5 years ago, it would be helpful to me.
Okay. John, we'll start with you.
Yeah, I think there's a couple of things that stand out for me, because I'm often confronted with the same exact situation. You've got somebody who's skeptical, and you want to try and convince them with something that you can point to. One of them is that for the last 150 years, that the average temperature of the globe has increased by a degree and a half Celsius. And that is irrefutable fact. And that's after much combing and much filtering of the data to make sure that there are not biases that are into that and all kinds of other things. People often throw up some skeptical questions about that. But that's a fact that can't be denied. Another is really intriguing because one of the controversies is, okay, if the globe is warmed up, does it really have anything to do with human activity? And most of us have a sense that it has to do with burning of fossil fuels. And you can show that not only has the carbon dioxide fraction gone up by a certain amount, leading to our current high amounts of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, but also the oxygen, molecular oxygen fraction, has gone down by exactly enough to have been involved in combustion of those carbon-based fuels. And that's really intriguing, because we have 21% of our atmosphere is oxygen, molecular oxygen, so it's a huge amount. But you can measure small changes in that large amount, and those small changes exactly plug in to the increases in carbon dioxide. To me, that's irrefutable evidence that the new carbon dioxide is there because something's been combusted.
Yeah. It's one thing to look at the data of climate change, but the second and third order consequences, and I'm thinking about Al Gore's An Inconvenient Truth and his assertion that the sea levels, given the melting of polar ice caps, could rise 20 feet with a consequent displacement of 60 million people in the Ganges River Delta. Are these data still reliable?
Well, I would put those at projections rather than data. So now they're trying to project out into the future of what would happen. And in that scenario, mm-hmm. you're talking about the Antarctic ice sheet melting. Mm-hmm. Now, whether or not that's going to occur is yet, you know, we don't really know that yet. So I wouldn't use that as specific data to demonstrate that global change is occurring. I mean, sea level is rising right now, but I wouldn't make the argument that it's going to be up 20 feet in 150 years from now.
Okay.
But I think other things like retreat of glaciers, the amount of time lakes are frozen, that's been reduced. The growth time of vegetation has been increased. So there's a lot of other evidence in support of the fact that, yeah, the and consistent evidence that the globe is on average warming.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The Global Institute for Environmental Research had estimated polar melting over the past five decades. They'd made an estimate, and it actually was considerably, the melting has been considerably fat. They're about 30 years ahead of what they had projected.
That's right. That's another good thing to throw at a person who's skeptical of projections. And Steve used exactly the right word. A lot of these forecasts or projections should not be considered data. They're forecasts. But it is interesting that a fairly recent one, the one Larry points out about polar, this northern hemisphere polar ice melting, is way behind the reality.
Yeah.
And these forecasts were made not that long ago.
Yep.
So,
and I'll just add on a cautionary note, don't get your hopes up, because if people want to believe that it's not happening, it's no matter how much evidence you put in front of them, they're just going to find a way
very
to ignore
good point.
It.
Very good point. Because belief shouldn't be a belief.
Right.
This
is the data that shows it's happening.
Linda in Woodstock, Illinois, it's your turn. Hi, Linda.
Hi there.
What can we do for you?
Well, I appreciate the opportunity to ask this question. The other morning I was listening to the forecast, and they had predicted freezing fog. Now, you described nicely freezing drizzle as opposed to freezing rain, but what is freezing fog?
That's a great question, and it's similar to freezing rain in the sense that they're liquid droplets that are suspended in the atmosphere. And so it's a fog that's made of liquid droplets. It's just that they're below freezing, and they can still be liquid. But as soon as they touch a surface, they freeze over.
Okay.
And so a freezing fog is a fog that's at a temperature below 32 degrees Fahrenheit. Mm.
Okay.
And they're really dangerous, although they can also cause beautiful rhyming, as an earlier caller pointed out. They can make really beautiful scenery.
Okay.
All right.
All right. Thank you so much.
Thanks very much for calling. I'm returning from my trip from Paris here a week or so back, and we were just on our descent into Madison, and then because of that fog, that freezing fog, we turned to the east and headed to Grand Rapids, Michigan for 3 hours or so.
Yeah, you don't want to fly in that stuff.
No.
It freezes. I mean, even big planes now have things that will actually start to defrost it. But once you start getting ice buildup on your wings, you lose the lift. And
especially when you're trying to land, you don't want to have that.
No. I was perfectly happy to go back over to Grand Rapids for 3 hours. Let's go to Carl in Madison. Hi, Carl.
Okay, having an opportunity to ask this question is more exciting than a visit to Santa Claus, because it's been vexing me since last summer when I first called into Larry's show to ask Dr. Sam Shakashiri about this. I read a report, a 2004 congressional report by a bunch of noted climatologists about methane hydrate, which is it's sort of like dry ice. Think of it that way, but it's methane that's in a solid form. It's in the ocean depths about 800 and plus feet down, and it's distributed all over the world. And the deposits are so vast that they're at least, and could be several times the amount of the fossil fuels that we know of and have used so far, including coal. And the report basically had two parts to it. One part, which was minor, but I've traced it down a little bit, is that if you can mine this stuff, and it's not simple, but it's doable, it will last a couple hundred years at least as a source of fuel. But the major problem is that if the stuff begins to dissociate, which would happen if the temperature of the water was raised by a degree and a half, or probably more close to 3 degrees, this stuff would disassociate, outgas. And methane is about 21 times more potent than carbon dioxide is as a greenhouse gas. And they say that could be as short as 10, but 20, 30 years, we're done for. Mm. Can the guys comment on this? Are they aware of all this stuff?
I became aware of it recently. I think it was a Modern Marvel show called Ice, where they talked about both aspects of this, both mining it and the fact that if it were to be, for whatever reason, melt and be released into the atmosphere, that there would be a huge increase in greenhouse gases.
It's in the ocean?
It's in the ocean, yeah.
And it's got to be very deep water then, right?
Right, yep.
I don't think anybody really has a good sense of how the global change and sea surface temperature changes are going to be reflected in the deep abyss. Yeah. It might be almost that they're immune to that, but of course not forever. I mean, you can't go on forever and not expect some of that heat to make its way down there. But I don't know how rapidly the deep water is going to feel the temperature increases at the surface. But I don't know any more than that.
Yeah. But this is a legitimate concern because I've been trying to follow this, and nobody seems to be interested in it. And like I say, there is a congressional report from 2004 and an ongoing investigations.
I think what's happening in our science is that, you know, with the climate change issue is that there are first-order questions, there are second-order questions, and then third-order questions. And really, that means priority, first, second, third priority questions. I would guess this is not a first-priority question, and that might be why, because it may be immune to immediate tapping of this dangerous event. But that might be why it's not so much in the headlines.
On the radar.
Yeah. As an issue.
Carl, thank you very much for calling. I want to give some others a chance to get in here. Appreciate your call. Tom in Columbus. We'll go to you next. Hi, Tom.
Good afternoon, gentlemen, and happy New Year to you all.
To you as well.
Show as usual, Larry. I'm going to change my question up. It kind of got answered, but the earlier one I had. But I guess my question is, as far as credentials, when we see the local television meteorologists and/or commentators talking, they have the AMA approval or whatever. What should we look for? What would be the best, as far as education that they're going to, publicly let us know that they've got? And do you see that is changing with this ongoing climate crisis, man-made or natural or whatever it is? Is the forecasting at the meteorological, personality level, will their credentials have to change in order to keep up with these changes? Or, what can we expect?
All right.
Yeah, I don't think that the credentials have to change in order to keep up with the global climate scenarios, because they're still doing forecasts primarily out to 3 days. Some go beyond that, I guess, but they probably shouldn't, right? Mm. So, you could look for things like the American Meteorological Society seal of approval, but things that I like to look for, I just keep track of whether or not they seem to be doing good.
Yeah.
And whether or not they seem to, personally to me, satisfy my own curiosity in terms of not just giving a prediction of what the temperature is going to be tomorrow, but actually explaining how well they explain what's going to be causing the weather of the next couple of days. That's what I base it on.
Yeah, same with me. And I think that AMS seal of approval is taking on a higher and higher profile. It really is a certification by the American Meteorological Society that this individual is a trained scientist in the field of meteorology. And they have to have a bachelor's degree in that science, not just in physics or something related, but directly in atmospheric sciences. And so it does testify to a level of qualification that I think was not the case even 15 or 20 years ago.
Yeah. All right. All right. Thanks, Tom, for calling. Mary and Franklin, your turn now. Hi, Mary.
Hello. When I hear the talk about global warming and global climate change, I wonder if any of the people and your speaker there in particular has read a book called uncontrollable global warming every 1,500 years. It is by a man, I believe his name is Singer, and about research that has been done by five well-known scientists from Europe. One is from Denmark, Switzerland, I believe France. I don't know where the other ones are from. But do you have anything to say about that, that every 1,500 years the climate does change?
Okay.
I mean, yeah, I mean, climate is always changing. You can go back 650 million years ago, whenever when the dinosaurs were around and we weren't around. And so things are different. I've never read that book. I have met Singer, if he is the author of that book. And he generally is one of the types that has an agenda on his mind. I mean, he's being often paid to represent a particular point of view. And so I wouldn't look at that book as a science book necessarily.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think it's important to point out, too, it's a hard point to get across in a short amount of time, but the way in which the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change is constructed is it's hundreds of scientists from around the world who are reviewing already peer-reviewed literature to try and distill from all of that what are the current states of knowledge on the comprehensive problem. And so every piece of information that goes into the IPCC report that's gotten all of the headlines since February has been reviewed by hundreds of scientists, and yet sometimes statements in some of these books have not undergone that same level of scrutiny, and as a consequence, the statements may not have as much truth in them, or at least not as much consensus about their veracity. And so those are some of the danger things to at least keep in mind when you read them. I there's nothing wrong with reading other people's views, but one has to understand the difference between how that view gets published versus the view expressed by the IPCC, how that gets published.
But climate does include cycles, and cycles means that things are changing. And so, yeah, that's not...
But you're saying the cycle that we're...
Yeah, what we're saying now is we're seeing a rate of change that we really aren't expected to see in natural type of situation. And that the change we're seeing is due to carbon emissions.
Right. It's not just coincidental with the industrial age. It's a consequence of the industrial age. That's the statement the IPCC is making now.
Yeah.
100 years is what he seems to say, that we have a cooling period and then it'll be a warming period. And we're in the warming period right now. I have to ask you, what would be his agenda for saying that if it isn't true, or the agenda of the scientists?
Well, I can only speculate on that. I know that there are powerful interests that mine petroleum out of the surface of the earth, and they would really love to have people stop worrying about global warming, especially stop pointing the finger at combustion of petroleum products. And they are bankrolled, and they can find people who will be spokespeople for them. And that might be one option. I don't know if that's the case here. It could very well be. Certainly, there's not only motive, but there's also opportunity and funding to make that happen. So I don't know. That's a good question. I don't know the answer. I can only speculate.
And I won't even speculate.
Thanks, Mary, for calling. I want to give some others a chance to get on here. Ron in Marshfield is next. Ron, hi to you.
Hey, Larry, how you doing?
Great. Thanks for calling.
Great. Steve, John, great show.
Thank you.
I just read a book, very disturbing, actually. It's Robert Felix, and the title of the book is not by fire, but by ice. And he's talking about ice ages. It's sort of written in stone. About every 11,500 years, magnetic pole reversal, volcanism, and all that kind of thing. He's going the opposite direction with all this.
Yeah.
You know? And I don't know if you read the book or know anything about him.
So is it by ice or is it not by fire, by ice?
Not by fire, but by ice.
But by ice. Okay.
I think I've heard of this. And I think one of his things is the slowdown of the thermohaline circulation in the North Atlantic, I think, is one of the things that he talks
about.
Right.
There are all these cycles he's talking about are coming together, like right now kind of thing.
Yeah, there are certainly elements of the argument in that. I haven't read the book, but I've heard... about
good
it,
book.
But certain elements of that argument are ones that people are currently concerned about on the other side of the issue, which is, you know, I think we're really looking toward a warmer future, but there may be things like the breakdown of the thermohaline circulation that are a consequence of some of the warming that we're seeing on the planet.
Right.
So I haven't read the book. I don't know any more of his details. But
yeah, Jim Packard thinks it's John Krakauer, the author of that. John Krakauer.
Oh.
So... We'll take a look at that.
Yeah, I haven't read it either, but
this is good
I see what John's
read.
Saying, yeah.
We'll take a look at that.
Getting a good
that.
Book list.
Yeah, I know.
We'll maybe we can talk about that next month if you guys have a chance to at least brush, we'll look through it. We will. Thanks, Ron, for calling. Eric in Sheboygan, your turn. Hi, Eric.
Hey, how you guys doing?
Good.
Great show, great topic, love it. Getting back to the caller that was asking about the NOAA voice sounding so electronic.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, pretty much no matter where he goes, it'll be the same voice. They do have to type, everything is typed up. You can find the same information online.
Mm. Yeah, okay.
As far as global warming, I believe, I mean, it's. I've done a lot of watching of programs on it, and if you look back at ice cores, basically it's, the Earth is in a continuous cycle, and there's lots of things that affect that. We affect it by burning fossil fuels, volcanic eruptions. Mm-hmm. Earth is, doesn't go around the sun evenly. It's where it is placed as far as how far away it is from the sun. And even as far as where the galaxy is in the universe, also has, they've found, has an effect as far as these cycles. So you have the major cycles as well as little micro cycles within those. From things that I've heard. I'm just wondering how much of this information you guys have heard.
Yeah, it's a very, very complicated system. It's, you could imagine it being like, some sort of a marionette device with millions of different handles, and every single one of them has an effect. There's no doubt that it's a complicated system, and that's what makes it a big problem to try and solve. But, you know, one of the things we've been learning over the last couple of decades is that human influence on that system is considerably more profound than we originally thought it could be.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We kind of tangle up the strings, don't we?
Yeah, that's right.
Kind of,
yeah.
That's right.
That's
right. Thanks. Thanks, Eric.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Yvonne and Brown Deer, your turn. Hi, Yvonne.
Good morning or good afternoon, whichever. I'm looking outside and it looks the same.
Must be white out there.
Yeah. So I don't know what level of question this is, but over some time in the past, I read that there had been a summer in the early 1700s, I think it was, where there was no summer, so there was a lot of salmon.
Mm. I know of one that I remember hearing about as a kid, and it affected New England. That's why I heard about it, was the year without a summer, 1816, I think. It was when, was it
Tambora.
Krakatoa? Tambora. Tambora erupted, and yeah, you know more about it than I do.
Yeah, right. There was, right, in 1816. So that would be the 17th, no. 17th century?
19th century.
Early
19th,
19th century, yeah. Whereas you're saying, yeah, there was a summer, a winter, a year without a summer.
Mm. And did that cause a lot of immigration?
Say that again?
Did it cause a lot of immigration?
I think it caused some because, as you were pointing out, there were a lot of crop failures, particularly in New England, in the continental U.S.
I think that was a time when we did get a lot of immigration from Europe.
Right, yep.
Yeah.
And it caused a lot of famine, caused the writing also of Frankenstein, indirectly. Yeah, because they were in England and they were vacationing in Switzerland, I think it was, and the weather was terrible, and so they didn't go out. And so they had a competition who could tell the scariest story, and
yeah.
Mary Shelley told the story
That's
of Frankenstein.
Awesome.
So, are you aware of any evidence of rising murders at that time, or suicides?
Oh, I don't know. That's a,
I don't either.
That's an
yeah,
interesting question.
Know.
Yeah, well, see, I'm getting cabin fever here.
So. Well, hold on. Turn on the sun lamp.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, right.
With the knife.
Turn on the
Get
sun
outside,
lamp.
Get outside, right? Or start telling ghost stories.
Yeah. Start telling ghost stories. Maybe you can make some money on that. I mentioned earlier the hottest day of the year. We want to go just look back here for a minute. The hottest day of the year was July 8th as the highs were in the 90s statewide. And the highest official reading was 99 degrees at both Grantsburg and Burnett County and Crivitz and Marinette County. Milwaukee hit 94 that day. The coldest temperature in the state was recorded on February 6th and 7th, both days, at Gurnee in Iron County, and it dropped to 35 degrees below zero.
That's cold.
Last year.
That's cold.
Oh, my goodness. Iron County had the most snow, too. They had 175.8 inches.
Probably half of it that week, when that cold air comes over the lake.
Oh, man.
You know, so I want to point out, last month, John accurately forecasted that we would have a white December.
Yeah.
And so now, is he going to forecast a cold February? You want to continue that monthly forecast?
I'll tell you, the first week of February will be the coldest week of the year. Almost every year is. First week or two of February, because in Madison it was February 16th last year. Almost always. So that would be consistent with you, Ryan, with temperatures. Yeah, so I won't say anything about it. It looks like the first week of January is going to moderate after a couple of cold days, but after that it's going to moderate for the first time in 7 or 8 weeks.
Well, I don't know
what happens after that.
On the hot side, we had 18 tornadoes in Wisconsin this past year with $16 million in property losses.
Almost a million a pop.
Happy New Year, you guys.
Thanks so much.
We'll see you again next year.
Yeah. Right. Looking forward to it already.
Steve Ackerman and John Martin, our weather guys, they will be back next year, the last Monday of January, and we will do this all over again with them. Thank you for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network. Happy New Year, everyone.